I'm John Batchelor, having a conversation with Patrick Scanlon, the author and professor of a new book, Rot. This is the story of the Great Irish Famine of the 1840s, Victorian times. And that famine was driven by conditions, yes, having to do with infestation of the potato fields, but also conditions created by the conquest and abuse of the Irish island by the English island. And there's too much history to recover everything, but we're continuing a conversation that turns on the blight hitting other parts of Europe as it came from the Americas. Remember, the potato came from the Americas originally, probably in the 16th century with fishermen and men returning from conquest in the Americas. But it had spread to the mainland and to Ireland. Ireland was unique in that so much of the diet of the poor depended upon the potato, and only the potato. The potato, the pig, and the turf were the three legs of the stool that sustained a poor peasantry that farmed. They didn't own their farms because that was part of the conditions laid down before they were born by the conquering English, who owned everything and rented it out. This is an island of landlords. Very few people own an enormous amount of farmland in Ireland, and so many of the millions of people who lived there were under the boot of the rent collection. But now we turn to Parliament, because after the Act of Union, Ireland put together with England and Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, there were members of Parliament from Ireland, and there were members of the House of Lords from Ireland, and they participated in the debates about what is to be done about the famine. We need now to introduce one of the prime ministers in this period. His name is Robert Peel. Patrick, Professor, what do we need to know about him and the famine?
Robert Peel is probably one of the most significant political figures of the first half of the 19th century in British politics. He was the leader of the Conservative Party, eventually was kind of drummed out of office by his own party for his support for free trade, which split. So the Conservative Party in the first half of the 19th century was for the most part protectionist. And Peel, in opposition to the more free trade oriented Whig party, although, you know, they wouldn't necessarily, there's less formal party structure now than there was later in the 19th century than there is now. But the, roughly speaking, the Tories were, protectionist and the Whigs were, in favor of free trade. And Peel, was a leading Tory, perhaps the leading Tory, certainly one of the signal, one of the most important figures in the party, who was prime minister at the beginning of the famine, and then was removed from office because of a rebellion by his own party in the House of Commons after he passed, with the support of the Whigs, a bill that repealed the Corn Laws, which were the major protectionist piece of legislation that protected the produce from British farms against competition from elsewhere. So in terms of his relationship to the famine, right, Peel, you know, I think was not perhaps as kind of like cold-blooded as he's sometimes portrayed in terms of his relationship to Ireland, but he was certainly, his approach to alleviating the suffering of the Irish poor was shaped by his faith in free markets and by his faith in free trade. And so when the famine struck, Peel was well aware of the danger. He launched a scientific commission that was sent to Ireland to try to figure out if there was some way of protecting Irish potatoes, and failing that, if there was some way of kind of some set of precautionary steps that farmers could take to inoculate themselves or their farms against the blight, and finding that that was impossible, Peel instituted what became the basic structure of famine relief in Ireland during the famine, which was a combination of public works that were paid for, that were designed to basically be the employer of last resort in the Irish countryside, where farmers or laborers who could not find work for wages from private employers would be able to work on public works projects that were funded through loans advanced by the British government to the to local Irish relief committees. And Peel was especially interested in importing food that the Irish could then buy at cost using the wages that they earned from public works. And Peel in particular wanted to import maize, what was often called at the time Indian corn, or like from the United States. And so Peel secretly had his bankers and his contacts in the banking. And Peel himself was the son of a very, very wealthy factory owner and merchant family from the north of England. He was his father, Robert Peel Sr., was also a member of parliament and a very, very wealthy man. And Peel kind of secretly used his contacts in the merchant and banking communities to buy a really enormous quantity of maize from the United States, which was then imported to Ireland and sold at cost through the same local relief committees organized in Ireland that were responsible for organizing public works projects. So Peel is a really, really important figure in the early history of the famine, but he's arguably an even more important figure in British politics in the 19th century because his turn to free trade completely redefined the political landscape of the United Kingdom in the 19th century. It ended, it made the Tories into the remains of the Conservative Party, reoriented around protectionism. The Liberal Party, which became one of the dominant political parties of the 19th century, formed from the Whigs uniting with the free trading Peelites. He was a really important figure for all kinds of reasons.
Another political figure at this moment, especially ironic given how famous he is for other matters, the man Arthur Wellesley. We know him as the Duke of Wellington, the conqueror of Napoleon and the continent for the English army. However, he was born in Ireland. He came from one of those Protestant families that was rewarded by the king once upon a time. And now and again, he was prime minister. Did he have an opinion of the famine when it struck?
So, I mean, Peel and Wellington, the Duke of Wellington, formed, they were the kind of backbone of the Conservatives. Wellington was not particularly sympathetic to the Irish poor.
You're generous, Patrick.
Yeah, he was not particularly sympathetic to the Irish poor. But by the time the famine rolled around, his moment at the center of British politics was sort of long over. Although he was still powerful in the Lords, he was no longer really like, he believed that it was exaggerated, right? And that it was a kind of, it was rumor that the rumors of mass starvation in Ireland were just that. They were rumors that were being spread by the faction in the British Parliament that were called the Repealers, who were members of Parliament, mostly like quite pious Catholics, led by Daniel O'Connell, who were arguing for the end of the Act of Union and the restoration, not the separation of Ireland from the British Empire, but the restoration of an independent Irish Parliament through the repeal of the Act of Union. And I think the Duke of Wellington believed that the famine was a kind of repealer myth, or that it was being exaggerated by the repealers to advance their cause.
Yes, they accused the Irish of poor mouth, right? They made
That's right.
them sound worse because they wanted benefactors to arrive on the scene. Wellesley and Peel both followed Malthus's understanding of how to treat the poor. Is that correct? They both understood that famine would drive them to work.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was definitely a lot of faith. I mean, I think it's you know, there's I don't want to I don't want to look there's enough evidence, I think, to show the ways that Britain's mindset towards poverty and its mindset towards empire and imperialism and colonialism, there's enough there to condemn the empire without kind of necessarily focusing in on individuals, right? I think one of the things I try to show in Rot is that, right, there are individuals in the British Empire who are deeply sympathetic to the Irish, and there are individuals who were contemptuous of them and scornful of them. There were people who were invested in ideas of civilization that were harmful to Ireland, but it was the structure of the empire itself and the structure that had been put in place, as we talked about earlier, by waves of colonization and subdivision of land and institutions like Conacher that made Ireland especially vulnerable to famine. And so in some ways, you know, I don't want to treat like it's not right to treat the Irish famine as inevitable, right? There were a series of political choices that happened that made famine possible in Ireland, but no single individual in Britain was responsible or, you know, like fully to blame. Like I think it lets the institutions of the British Empire off the hook if you personalize blame in the history of the famine.
The book is Rot, An Imperial History of the Great Irish Famine. Patrick Scanlon is the author. There's one detail here. The poor people, the starving people, didn't just sit there. They fought back. When we come back, the understanding of violence in the countryside, especially if you were looking to collect rent. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Patrick Scanlon. His book is Rot. It's about the peculiar abuse of Ireland over several hundred years by the English conquerors, both the Protestants and the mixed post-Protestant England. But at this point, there was a reputation the Irish had that is, you think later on, well, all right, this is a rounded story, and that's what Patrick's telling, a rounded story. The opinion in London was that the Irish were violent and lawless, and that if you went there, you better have bodyguards. And if you were collecting rent, it was dangerous. Is that all correct, Patrick?
Yeah. I mean, Ireland was a really, the Irish countryside was pretty volatile. And there were, you know, there was an instrument that was put in place early under the Act of Union called the Coercion Acts, which were laws that could be passed by the, by a parliament in London that would then, dramatically restrict civil rights in Ireland in order to pass through what was judged by Parliament to be a crisis.
And this is in addition to the laws against the Catholics. This is
well, those had been laws. The laws that restricted Catholic practice and that restricted Catholic landowning were abolished in 1829. So, you know, almost two decades after, almost three decades after the Union. But the Coercion Acts were designed to kind of give the British state in Ireland, in the figure of the Lord Lieutenant, who was the kind of chief executive of British power in Ireland.
At Dublin Castle.
At Dublin Castle. They would give the Lord Lieutenant the power to declare certain districts of the country to be under, to like suspend habeas corpus, to permit not summary judgment, but at least like summary, like searching of premises and seizing of people. Like they were ways of kind of suspending the usual rules of civil law, because the countryside could be very volatile. And there were a lot of feuds and a lot of violence. The euphemism that was used in the British press was outrages, right? So when they described, when you see, if you're reading a 19th century newspaper and you see outrages in the countryside mentioned, that means, either, an arson, you know, or a murder or an assault on a landlord or a landlord's agent or on another tenant. And that those outrages continued during the famine. They ramped up, especially in the first wave of the famine in 1846, 1847. As Ireland descended deeper into and towards starvation, they got worse. There was certainly violence in the countryside, and in the depths of the famine, anytime, you know, when wages were being paid out at the public works, they would be sent out in two identical carts, one that had the money in it and one that was empty to kind of offer a decoy, right? This was a very, unsettled and for many people, like very dangerous landscape. And that danger wasn't just to British officials or to wealthier Irish people. It was dangerous for everyone, right? Especially in the depths of the famine.
You talk about the paying of rent. I wanted to I'm glad you remind me. Ireland didn't have any cash around. Why not? Where did it go?
So Ireland, I mean, generally Britain had very little cash, right? There's just it's interesting too, because there's just relatively little circulating money, in the United Kingdom at this time. A lot of the money that circulates is, you know, if you were going to pay for something in the early 19th century, you know, you would get, if you had money drawn on the Bank of England, you could basically spend it at its face value. So if you had £5 drawn on the Bank of England on a note, right, you could spend that as though it were £5. But a lot of the money that was circulating in Ireland was drawn on other merchants or on smaller banks or on individuals. So let's say I had, you know, £5 drawn on a merchant in Dublin, and I was in Cork trying to buy a horse, let's say, my £5 wouldn't be worth £5, because that paper that I had would be discounted by the person accepting the money, because they weren't sure whether or not it could actually be redeemed for the value that was printed on it, right? So there was very little circulating money of any kind in Ireland. A lot of the stuff that was circulating were IOUs and other forms of often individualized debt, which wouldn't be necessarily a problem, because that's what happened in England as well, and in the early Republic, and in the kind of late colonial United States as well, right? These are not places where there's tons of sort of government issued specie or paper being circulated. But in Ireland, that absence of circulating money was treated as evidence of a lack of civilization, in part because one of the key points, or one of the key examples, for Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations for the relative developing economic civilization of a country is the degree to which it uses abstract instruments to represent monetary value. So for Smith, right, barter is like the kind of first form of economics where people exchange goods without really a sense of their monetary value. You know, they just exchange it based on their needs. And for Smith, there's a kind of increasing, there's level after level of increasing sophistication and abstraction. So next it's just using gold, and then it's using gold pieces, and then it's using paper money that represents gold, and then it's using debt. And so for Smith, you know, that was represented civilization, and that idea of civilization circulated widely as well. So the absence of circulating money in Ireland was taken as further evidence of a lack of civilization in the Irish countryside.
There were remedies offered, and when we come back, the soup kitchens. The book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Great Famine of Ireland. Patrick Scanlon is the author. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor, speaking with Associate Professor at the Center for Industrial Relations and Human Resources in the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies, University of Toronto, Patrick Scanlon. And we're about to ask the professor to take us by the hand and lead us through the poor laws of the British Isles, not only in the 19th century, but I learned stretching back into medieval times. These are important to understand the remedy that was offered the starving people of Ireland after the blight swept them, and especially the Black 47. That's the winter of 46-47. Patrick, what were the poor laws and what were they meant to achieve? Good evening to you again.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So the poor laws as you say, a kind of early modern origin. So they were first passed in the era of just of the consolidation of the English Reformation under Elizabeth I. So they're often called the Elizabethan poor laws. And they followed from the dissolution in the era of the English Reformation of Catholic monasteries and almshouses, and their replacement with a kind of Anglican parish-based system of relief. And so the Elizabethan poor laws are complicated, and probably not going through the intricacies of the laws are probably less interesting to your listeners. But in a kind of thumbnail sketch, the Elizabethan poor laws are designed to offer people who live in specific localities relief in times of economic distress in the places where they are registered and recorded as living, right? So there's two elements to the Elizabethan poor laws. One is what's called the law of settlement, which is the idea that you can only seek
relief, poor relief in the place where you are registered. And the other is relief itself. And generally speaking, the Elizabethan poor law was designed to provide people with relief based on the fluctuation in the availability of food and money and in the price of bread. And I'm like, there are historians of the Elizabethan poor laws who would like tear their hair out of this characterization because it was there's a lot that goes on in that history. But briefly, like the idea of the Elizabethan poor law is to relieve people who are suffering by either giving them food or money in order at times when unemployment rises or when the price of bread rises so high that most people can't reach it. And so by the end of the 18th century, the basic model was that, you know, that when was to index poor relief to the price of bread. So if people were, you know, were unable to afford, if their wages were too low to afford whatever the cost of bread was in a given parish, then the parish would give them money that would kind of top up their wages. And in practice, that had a lot of like pretty serious distorting effects on the English economy, and it pushed down wages for a lot of laborers, right? Because the idea was that the parish rates would fill up, would top people up to whatever the price of subsistence was at any given time. And so in 1834, the British Parliament amended the poor law and put it in place what was called the Poor Law Amendment Act, which came to be known by most people as the new poor law. And the new poor law was premised on a different model of poor relief. It was premised on the idea that the only people who could receive relief from local relief officials, from parishes, were people who were willing to submit to the discipline of living in a workhouse. So the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act increased the number of workhouses across Britain and required that anyone who sought poor relief would have to receive their relief as what was called inside relief or indoor relief. So in order to receive food or money or shelter, people would have to submit to workhouse discipline. They would have to effectively incarcerate themselves inside a workhouse in exchange for poor relief. And the Poor Law Amendment Act initially included absolutely no provision for what was called outdoor relief, which was the more familiar Elizabethan model of poor relief, which was to give people food or money or other forms of support in times of economic distress outside of the walls of a workhouse. So that's what was meant by outdoor relief. And the other principle of the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act was what's called the principle of least eligibility, which is to say that conditions within a workhouse had to be worse than the conditions of paid work anywhere outside of the workhouse. The idea being that the workhouse ought to deter people from seeking poor relief rather than encourage them to seek poor relief. And so those two mechanisms were the two kind of core principles of the amended poor law. And in fact, the amended poor law was seen as being too severe and was quickly watered down a little bit by the English Parliament because to sort of allow outdoor relief under certain circumstances. But in 1838, the Irish Poor Law was passed, and it was a copy of the English Poor Law with the proviso that absolutely no poor relief outdoors could ever be given. So that was the kind of basic principle of poor relief at work in the 1830s in the United Kingdom.
And you can see that not only was ineffective, but it responsible for the mass death that followed the 46-47 winter conditions. There was one other remedy that was offered. In other words, you were meant to starve because that could get you to work. And only in the workhouses would you be fed, but you'd be fed in conditions that were worse than you could find outside where you were starving. This is amazingly over-the-top blame the victim. But I want to go to one other remedy that sounds benign. What was the soup kitchen?
So in the depths of the crisis in Ireland, the initial mechanism for relieving the poor in the Irish famine was premised on the idea that the kind of basic principles of the market could be applied to the Irish countryside to feed the hungry, right? So both the Tory government under Robert Peel and then the Whig government under John Russell followed a kind of two-pronged strategy of importing American maize, what was called Indian corn at the time, which was chosen specifically because it was a crop that would not grow in Ireland and consequently could not interfere with the ostensible normal progress of Irish trade, and would be imported in quantity and then sold at cost to people in Ireland to feed them. And the other prong of the strategy, the famine relief strategy, was to introduce public works programs that would be the kind of employer of last resort in the Irish countryside, where people who were hungry could find work if they could find no other paid work. And the work they found at public works would always be set at a rate of wages that was lower than the lowest possible private wage outside of the public works. And people would work on the public works in order to earn money to buy the imported grain. And as that strategy began to collapse, in part because the price of maize continued to rise, people didn't know how to prepare it or how to eat it, and so it was making a lot of people sick. And more people went to the public works, which was never the intention of the public works. They were supposed to be an employer of last resort, but by the winter of 1847, there was something like 700,000 people employed on the public works, supporting as many as 1.5 million more people with those wages. And that provoked a financial crisis in the British government. And the solution was to amend the Irish Poor Law with a temporary relief act, the of 1847, which temporarily would permit outdoor relief, which we just discussed, at Irish workhouses through the provision of soup kitchens, basically allow local relief committees to give food to people who were hungry, again, often through means testing, right? The idea that only people who could prove that they had no other source of food would be able to access a soup kitchen. But the soup kitchens were designed to kind of feed people as a last resort. And that was a rare instance, actually, in famine relief of something that had been tried on the ground, not by government officials, that was then adopted by the government. So the Society of Friends, the Quakers, had instituted soup kitchens earlier in the winter of 1846, 1847. And then it was rolled out nationally in the early spring and summer of 1847.
But there was nothing compassionate about it. You had a line of 100 people who were given 6 minutes to eat from a bowl of soup and a piece of bread. And then they were out replaced by another 100.
So that was the most famous soup kitchen was founded by a man named Alexis Soyer, who was a kind of celebrity chef of the 1830s. He was the head chef at the Reform Club, which at the time, which still exists as a kind of fancy social club, but at the time was the unofficial political headquarters of the Whig Party. And Soyer set up a model soup kitchen. I mean, he was, you know, he's an interesting guy. He is a kind of combined sort of passion. He was sincere in his desire to help people, but he also was interested in being seen to help people in order to enrich himself. So he had this kind of like humanitarian. He had a humanitarian mindset, but he was also interested in making a buck, and who later became quite famous and wealthy, creating and selling mobile catering equipment in the Crimean War, which cleaved to the same principle, right? It saved a lot of British soldiers, many of whom were Irish, from death by food poisoning, but also by allowing the preparation of more, like the more sanitary preparation of food in the field, but at the same time made Soyer a huge amount of money through government contracts to sell this mobile catering equipment to the Royal Navy and the Marines and the Army. And so Soyer set up a model soup kitchen in Dublin where, yes, people were fed his special recipe soup in large groups, and they were given 6 minutes to eat from a bowl in this kind of state of the art system, where the bowls would kind of like rise up out of the table and then be dunked in a bowl of water and then rise up again. So it was a kind of performance for the Dublin bourgeoisie and aristocracy of both famine relief, but also of the kind of wonders of modern chemical and culinary and catering technology. So not every soup kitchen was like that, but I think going to a soup kitchen anywhere in Ireland would have probably been a pretty miserable and humiliating experience, but maybe not as dramatically humiliating as it was for people who went to the soup kitchen in Dublin that Soyer ran.
I'm speaking to Patrick Scanlon. His book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Irish Famine. There's one more remedy. It's called de-roofing. When we come back, I'm John Batchelor with the author Patrick Scanlon. His book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Irish Famine. The rules, the laws, all punished people because they were starving, but not starving enough. Some of the people failed to pay their rent to the landlords who didn't much live there, but they had rent collectors. And if you didn't pay, or even if you did, why did they de-roof? What was the thinking, Patrick?
So de-roofing is not just briefly, right? So most people who are poor laborers in Ireland live in cottages that are thatched and that are rented, right? So these are cottages, the walls of which are built of stone, and then the roof is made of thatch that requires, pretty steady maintenance to continue to be weatherproof and kind of leak resistant. And so it had been a kind of feature of evictions in Ireland that when someone was evicted from their cottage, the bailiffs would pull the thatch off the roof in order to make the cottage basically effectively uninhabitable, to sort of evict people, but also guarantee that they not return to their cottage as squatters because the roof had been removed. And in the depths of the famine in Ireland, evictions, which had been a feature of Irish rural economy for a long time. And I think one of the things that I try to argue in Rot is that the Great Famine itself from 1845 to 1851 was the most cataclysmic and the most profound crisis in subsistence crisis or famine crisis in the Irish countryside, but it wasn't the first one. And it had many features in common with previous moments of famine and crisis. And one of those was a spike in evictions. So in the depths of the famine, partly from people being unable to pay their rent, and also sometimes from landlords defaulting on their tenancies, a lot of people were evicted. So in Ireland, right, the land was heavily subdivided. So somebody who rented 100 acres of land as a farmer would then subdivide that land in order to make the rent that they owed to their landlord, who was often an aristocrat, often, as you say, not resident in Ireland at all. And so whether... If one of those kind of tenants higher up on the pyramid of landlordism in Ireland got evicted, everyone below them got evicted as well. So if I rented 100 acres of land and I had 100 families living on quarter acre lots on my land, and I was unable to meet my rent obligations, it was at the discretion of the new tenant whether or not they wanted to continue to honor all of the subleases that I, sometimes informal subleases that I had made with all of my subtenants. And so every time land changed hands in Ireland, people got evicted, in part because the structure of land tenure in Ireland was pyramidal. And everyone was, not everyone, but many people in the Irish countryside were entangled in really complex relationships of landlordism and tenantism with one another. And so in the depths of the famine, right, that process continued and it accelerated as more people defaulted on their rent, more people had the roofs torn off of their cottages, which was one of the spurs that provoked really rapid and kind of panicked emigration from Ireland. And again, that was something that was familiar, right? Ireland had been a source of emigrants for a very long time. But in the famine and then in the wake of the famine and in the decades afterward, the emigration from the Irish countryside only increased in scale. And it started in a panic in 1847. In 1846, it became more organized and less panicked later, but it didn't stop. And I think unroofing is a kind of very powerful symbol of some of the forces that pushed people from the Irish countryside into emigration.
Yes, the Irish population in total fell 20% by 1851 from 1821. And the rural population, I'm following Patrick's reporting, fell 25%. Is the blight still in Ireland? Do they have memories of it?
So, you know, in some ways, I think the blight is still biologically in Ireland, right? There's still, it's still a pest that, that Irish farmers who grow potatoes need to be mindful of. Although now, I think it's most nightshades have to be sprayed as a matter of routine with antifungals, especially, I think it's, forget the compound, but with the chemical compounds that, that inhibit fungal growth. And so in some ways, like the potatoes that you eat at the supermarket now are technological marvels, right? They require really sophisticated antifungal management, and they also require a really complex cold chain. Like if you buy a bag of potatoes are not, do not travel well with outside of a pretty sophisticated shipping and climatic, like microclimactic conditions that need to be maintained around the potatoes so they don't sprout in the bag. As anyone who's like left a bag of potatoes in their pantry for more than a couple of weeks will have noticed. So yeah, the blight fit biologically is still in Ireland. I think the memories of the blight are there as well, but I think they're much more prevalent. Like the history of Ireland for the diaspora is much more about the potato famine than the history of Ireland for Irish citizens in the present, right? I think that in for present day Ireland, right, this like sophisticated, wealthy EU member state, right, the famine is less the founding moment of the Irish nation in comparison with, say, the Irish Wars for Independence or the Easter Rising in 1916, or the Irish Civil War that followed Irish independence in the 1920s. Like those are much more formative historical events for contemporary Ireland. But for the diaspora, the famine is absolutely at the center of a lot of people's sense of themselves as Irish, or their sense of themselves as Irish Canadian or Irish American or Irish Australian or Irish hyphen anywhere.
I know my family has married many Irish women in the last 9 generations, Patrick, so we're all a little Irish here in the Americas. Patrick Scanlon, the book is Rot, An Imperial History of the Irish Famine. I'm John Batchelor.